Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
My job in this session is to talk about questions 113 and 114 and their subject, which is the effects of grace. And Aquinas identifies two principal effects, justification and merit. So these are two big subjects. Justification, that is being, you might say, being the effect of being reconciled with God, put back into right order with him, receiving the gift of righteousness or justice. That's coming out of St. Paul's letter to the Romans. And then merit. And we're going to have an opportunity to see some of the differences between a Protestant, especially a Lutheran approach, and a Thomistic or Catholic approach. But of course, there's a lot of material, and I'm going to try to do something in the middle here about the possibility of like how God works within the will, and then the ways that we can understand the human will, not just going along with this, but perhaps resisting, because in a way, that's also an issue when we're talking about the transformation of the sinner or the reception of grace by the sinner, because before you're transformed by grace, you're a sinner. You're resisting. Okay. There's, of course, a lot of other good things to say. But the first thing I'd like to point out, and this isn't in the text that you have, but it's the prologue to question 113, where Aquinas is taking up the new subject. He says that question 113, which is about the justification of the impious, he says this is the effect of operating grace, and then merit, that's going to be question 114, is the effect of cooperating grace. So those are these categories that we've seen before, and as I mentioned briefly in response to a question, operating grace, it's the opposite sort of terminology than we normally think. Operating grace is where God moves us or turns us away from sin towards himself. So conversion is very, you know, very strong primary kind of example there. Whereas cooperating grace is not about us cooperating with God, but about God cooperating with our action. And Aquinas says something interesting when he discusses operating and cooperating, which are actually turns out are very important categories for him. Operating and cooperating are, he says, the same grace, but distinguished according to their effects or the way we look at them. So what does he mean by that? I think you could think about this in this way. Suppose suppose we were to take, let's pick on Father Justin. And let's posit for a moment that at one point Father Justin was a sinner, and that Father Justin, let's say he was in college and just not living a Christian life, and at a certain point received a grace of conversion in college. I actually don't remember if this is part of your story, but I'm just going to impose it on you. We'll just pretend that it is. So let's suppose that Father Justin at one moment receives a profound grace to turn to God, and he begins to change his life. The beginning of that grace is interior. So there's some moment, perhaps, where he realizes, I need God, and I need to change my life. And God is offering me mercy, and I want that mercy. So he resolves to do that. And that first moment of turning back to God or loving God, this is like the most prime example of the operating grace in him, where previously he was turned away from God and now he's been turned back. And Aquinas thinks you can only account for that kind of movement because of God's action. So the human being having rejected God or being in a state of sin doesn't have the power to reconcile itself back to God. And God has to take the initiative in that. So operating grace. But that operating grace then has to be sort of followed through on by, for example, the exterior action of going to the Catholic Church and asking to be baptized, or going to the Catholic Church and going to confession. And then all the things that follow from that. And where does it lead Father Justin? It leads him to today, where he is the man that you see here. So in a certain sense, we could say that that original operating grace, and maybe that was 20 years ago, is still at work in him, in its effects that God is now cooperating with. So now Father Justin is like, he's been turned by God and he's moving in the right direction, and God is continuing to support and uphold him in all of the things that have come from that grace, which may in a certain sense be a long time ago, and in another sense we could say that grace is still active. And I think this is true about the grace of a conversion, or the grace to, say, become a Christian. We want to talk about God's initiative, but also our action. So the pure gratuity of where that whole form of life comes from, and also the fact that we are now actually really doing something, and God can grant a certain reward to that action, which has a kind of look like repayment or merit. In other words, the root of the action is grace. But God says, yeah, when you do these things, I'm going to repay you. And aren't there many passages where Jesus tells parables in the Gospels that are like this, that are talking about, say, you know, the owner of the vineyard calling laborers into his vineyard, and they do actually do some labor, and then he repays them, and he may repay them much more generously than they deserve, but that there is still some kind of payment. And so there is what appears to be something that looks like, you know, work and reward, labor and merit, but in fact, it's all founded on an initial grace. So that's the big picture that we're going to see in questions 113, 114. Okay, let's look at 113, Article 1. And we're talking about the justification of the ungodly. Aquinas asks, is the justification of the ungodly the remission of sins? So on one level, we could say, is this article of Aquinas just concerned with wording? Is it just terminology here? That grace moves you from one status to another status? Is it just about your status, or we can even call it a stance? How can a sinner, insofar as he is a sinner, be justified? And this isn't an idle question, because Martin Luther famously claimed that we are simul justus et peccator. So at the same time, a just or righteous person and a sinner. And Luther's claim was that justification doesn't change us from being sinners. It doesn't change us from being impious. Rather, it just decrees that we're no longer under God's wrath. So, in that sense, you could still be in yourself really a sinner, really disordered from God, turned away from God in some sense, and justified, because being justified really, on Luther's account, or on this account, would be something different from being a sinner. It would involve God giving you a different status, although your essence remains the same. But as we'll see, that's not the way Aquinas thinks it works. Aquinas uses a different analogy, an analogy of a change. he calls it a motion in this, but yeah, for Aquinas, a motion is really just a way to speak about a change. And the analogy he mainly uses is that of heating something. A cold thing is made into a hot thing. So if we were to look at Aquinas's answer, he's talking about what happens in the change. And he clarifies what he means about justification. Justification means being made just. Another way of using a word here that might sound strange to our ears, but maybe is a little, helps us grasp a little more immediately what Aquinas is talking about when he says justification, is it's like the justicing of something. You get justiced. And what does he mean by that? You get made just. There is a change in you to make you just. So it's a change or a movement from being unjust or sinful or turned away from God to being just or righteous or rightly ordered to God. Okay, so justification refers to a sinner being moved to justice. So you have actually here a beginning point and an end point. The beginning point is being a sinner. The end point is being justified by a gift of grace. And that is, on Aquinas' account in this article, being put back in right order. So he says there are two ways that you can be put back into a right order. Let's just look at Aquinas' text. He says, justification taken passively implies a movement to justice, just as heating implies a movement towards heat. But since justice by its nature implies a certain rectitude of order, it may be taken in two ways, either with respect to a man's act, and then he talks about justice as a virtue, or as a rectitude of order in the interior disposition of a man, insofar as what is highest in man is subject to God and the inferior powers of the soul are subject to the superior, that is, to the reason. Okay, so what we're really interested in is not that first category, but that second category, the right order in someone's interior dispositions. That's what we're really talking about when we talk about the justification of a sinner. And here, Aquinas points out, he contrasts our situation with that of Adam. Okay? Adam was created in grace and then disobeyed God. So in the first sin, the sin of Adam, a man who had his intellect and will rightly ordered to God, like knowing God and loving him, turned away from God to focus on something apart from God, ultimately himself. And Aquinas' theory of the fall is actually directly flows from this. He says when man turns away from God, then even what is within man, so man has rebelled against what is higher, then what is within the human being, we experience the effects of that rebellion. So what is highest in us, we discover the lower powers rebel against what is highest in us. What's highest in us? Our minds. So our minds are no longer totally in control of our life. And we discover that our lower powers, like our passions, don't listen to our minds anymore and are constantly trying to get us to do things that we know we shouldn't do. And we experience a conflict within us. Now, have you experienced anything like this? I'm betting that you have. This is the result of original sin. So what Aquinas wants to talk about is how it's possible for some reordering to happen in the human being. And he says this is to be transformed by a movement from being disordered back to being ordered to God. And that's what we talk about as justification. You're being rightly ordered back to God. So this is, in a way, just what it means, Aquinas thinks, to be justified. Maybe now we could just move on to Article 2, where he asks, is grace required for this justification by the remission of sin? And Aquinas' answer, well, we might ask, is an infusion of grace required for sin to be remitted? What are the other possibilities? Well, that you could do it by your own natural power. That would be one possibility. Aquinas certainly rejects that. Another possibility might be, well, God just changes his mind with respect to you. So there's no infusion of grace in you. There's just like God making a decree about you, which wouldn't be the same as infusing grace. You see the difference? Infusing grace is like, you could think of like getting an injection. There's something that's really coming from God, or a change that God is bringing about by infusion in you. Something new within you. Whereas we could just think about this as a change in God's categories. Like God just kind of mentally puts you in a different category. That's closer to the Lutheran position. Aquinas is going to describe a change which is wrought by infusion. Is there a question? Just puzzled looks, but that's okay. We'll just keep going. Okay, so let's look at Aquinas' argument here in brief. He writes, I answer that by sinning, a man offends God, as stated above. Now, an offense is remitted to anyone only when the soul of the offender is at peace with the offended. Okay, so sin offends God. An offense is remitted only when the one offended is at peace with the offender. And he continues, hence, sin is remitted to us when God is at peace with us. And this peace consists in the love whereby God loves us. Okay, so what's the core insight here? No matter how much you want to be at peace with God, you can't forgive yourself. This is a relationship with someone else, with God, who you've offended by your sin. So God has to forgive you, or there's no forgiveness of sins. So that's basically true about a human relationship. It's much more true about our relationship with God. Okay, so how is the offended, how is God restored to peace with us? And Aquinas says, well, it's not going to be because of us giving something to God. It's going to be, rather, by God loving us. So this goes back to the point that I was making in the first talk, that God's love is the root of all graces. So God forgives us not because we're good, but because he's good and because he wants to share his goodness with us. So let's see what Aquinas says about this. He says, God's love, considered on the part of the divine act, is eternal and unchangeable. Whereas as regards the effect it imprints on us, it is sometimes interrupted, inasmuch as we sometimes fall short of it and once more require it or recover it. Now, the effect of the divine love in us, which is taken away by sin, is grace, whereby a man is made worthy of eternal life, from which sin shuts him out. Hence, we could not conceive the remission of guilt without the infusion of grace. Okay, so on the side of God, there's no change. But the effect in us can change when we turn away from God. And God restores us to his love by infusing grace into us. In other words, by turning us back to himself. And this is the remission of sins. Well, we're going to talk more about that in just a minute. So hang on to that. So that's going to involve us in a mystery, you know, the mystery of God's permission of sin. I mean, you could pose the question more fundamentally, like, why wouldn't God just prevent me from ever committing a sin? You know, couldn't he do that? By the way, definitely yes. He did that with the Blessed Virgin Mary. Why didn't he give you the same grace that he gave to the Blessed Virgin Mary? She didn't deserve it. She didn't do anything to get that grace. She got that grace at the first instant that she existed. So she couldn't have done anything. He didn't give that grace to you or to me. Why not? Good question. We don't really have an answer to that. But what we can be sure of is I didn't deserve that grace. And neither would you. So, and for that matter, neither did the Blessed Virgin Mary. That's what we're talking about here, is the total gratuity of God's gift. So now we're coming up against like deep mysteries, and probably lots of questions are arising in your mind. So hold on to those. We'll talk about those more. Like, wouldn't it have been a better world if there had been no sin? Like, that's the most fundamental question, right? Wouldn't there have been a better world if there had been no sin? And we want to say, sure seems like it to me. And, like, let's just follow out that thought experiment for a moment. Okay, so, like, I'm going to give God a call and be like, Lord, sure, we've been talking about this down here. And we're basically unanimously agreed. It would have been better for you to create a world where there had been no sin. And by the way, God can do that without compromising the freedom of the Blessed Virgin Mary, because her acts are all free. So don't assume here that if God's going to create free creatures, he must create sinful creatures. He could have made just one angel, for example, who by a free act eternally chose God. Why didn't he just do that? Why didn't he create two angels? Okay, why didn't he just create, you know, 100 million angels, all of whom don't fall? I think we'd have to say he could do that. Okay, but if we call God and say that to him, what are we in effect saying? In effect, we're saying, we know better than you what the best plan is. Now, are you ready to go to the bank with that? I think no. I think the answer to that is my intellect is very small and limited, and I do not understand God's plan. So what I know, what are the certitudes of faith that I really can go to the bank with? God is infinite and perfect. God is perfectly wise. He is all powerful. He is perfectly good, and he is love itself. God loves me, and the only reason I'm able to, like, say anything to him is because of his grace, because he loves me. Given all of that, I know that his plan is going to be better than mine. And I also know that, in principle, I'm not going to be able to understand his plan. So I should be humble when standing before God. And I should not accuse God of having a bad plan just because I don't see why sin should be a part of the picture, why he should let sin be part of the picture. I mean, we can be certain that God hates sin and that he's willing to die, literally, in order to destroy its power. So I think the answer, ultimately, to the question of evil and sin is to point at the cross and say, that's God's answer. He's willing to assume a human nature and experience all the worst effects of sin so that we could be freed of the dominion of sin and death. But he does permit some sin to exist. Although it seems probable that he permits much, much less to exist than if we were in charge of things. In which case, things would be much worse. Okay, so these are very deep mysteries. Like, this retreat is not going to resolve that question. Other than just to be forced to acknowledge that if we are tempted to, like, rebel or say, you know, God, I don't think this is a good plan. Maybe we should think twice about that. That's what I'm trying to get at. Yeah.
If you could just clarify, whenever you were talking about how, like, is like grace required for the remission of sin, and then talking about how there would either be an infusion of grace by God or God changing, like, the sinner's position, could you explain more about that? Because I think initially, to me, it sounded like God would say the sin that you just committed isn't a sin anymore. Or, like, is that what you were saying? Of, like, or was it just, like, we're, like, or is it more of a thing of, like, God is, like, pardoning this?
Well, I think what we'd be saying is God would decide to not regard your sin. Your sin would still be there.
Okay.
But he would... Like, the classical way that we talk about this, like, oh, you know, his son, say, steps in front of you.
Yes.
So that he sees the merits of his son and he no longer sees the sin, you know, your sinfulness. So this would not involve any change in you. This is somehow just, like, you end up being in the category of under the mercy of God. Mm-hmm. Whereas before you were in the category of under the wrath of God.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
And
that is a kind of classic Protestant account, but that's not the Catholic account. The Catholic account actually says it's not just a change of the category you're placed in some sense. You're being changed so that you start to be more loving of God. God's putting you back into relationship with him. So let's take a look at Article 3, which is about... whether your will moves when this justification happens. So Aquinas asks, whether for the justification of the ungodly, there is required a movement of the free will. Now you might think, oh boy, this is going to be an especially thorny question. How is it that God can move the will in order to for you to freely turn away from sin or freely repent? But actually what you see here is Aquinas answers in a very straightforward way. He just doesn't think that this is a really hard question, actually. Which I think should point out to us that if we think it's a hard question, maybe we're not thinking about it according to the same categories that Aquinas has. And I think that's in fact the case often. Okay, let's just see what he says. The justification of the ungodly is brought about by God moving man to justice. For he it is that justifieth the ungodly, according to Romans 4:5. Now God moves everything in its own manner. Or we could say according to its nature, right? He moves things according to its nature. Just as we see that in natural things, what is heavy and what is light are moved differently on account of their diverse natures. Okay, that example maybe isn't immediately obvious to us if you think of modern physics, but think of it in kind of a naive way. If you have helium or you have granite, like, they behave differently in this room. Helium goes up and granite goes down. And that's, you know, on that, a helium balloon is light and moves up. Whereas granite, you know, you might say it's lighter than the air in the room, less dense, so it's moving up. The granite is more dense, it's moving down. They move differently according to their diverse natures. So then Aquinas resumes, So God moves man to justice according to the condition of his human nature. Okay, how is human nature moved? You could move human nature like you move granite by, you know, exerting a force on it, a bodily force. Is that the way human beings are properly moved? Well, I mean, only if you're like the Metropolitan Transit Authority, you think of human beings that way, like a certain amount of weight to be moved from one point to another. No, you move human beings through their wills. Like, that's how you want to motivate people. That's how human beings, as human beings, move. Human beings can move as bodies by a force applied to them. And we can think of human beings like we could do a physics problem where instead of a rock, you got a human body. But that is an abstraction of what a human being really is to like a mathematical entity that we're going to be able to map on the blackboard or on the whiteboard in this case. But to move a human being as a human being involves moving a human being through its desires. And in fact, not the way you move a horse. How do you move a horse? You can push a horse, of course, but the main way you move a horse is either with a carrot or a stick, right? You know, a horse gets moved through its sense appetites. You prod it with something uncomfortable, or you give it something that's attractive to it, and you move it that way. Human beings don't move just that way. Like, we're not just talking about carrot and stick. We're talking about appealing to the mind so that you get the mind to desire something. That's the proper way to move a human being. And Aquinas says that's how God moves us. But it is proper, he says, it is man's proper nature to have free will. Hence, in him who has the use of reason, God's motion to justice does not take place without a movement of the free will. But he so infuses the gift of justifying grace that at the same time, he moves the free will to accept the gift of grace in such as are capable of being moved thus. And what he means by that is in adults. So babies don't work in the same way because God justifies a baby at baptism without a movement of the free will. That's a kind of special case. The more typical example of the justification of the impious is an adult conversion. And that happens through through God moving your free will to accept the gift of grace. So it's not just that God offers something, and then you, without any effect of God on your will, decide to accept it. Aquinas' picture is God offers something, and he acts within you so that you accept it. And here I think the picture of what's really happened to us in sin is also important to keep in mind. And here, you know, Augustine is really helpful. How many of you read Augustine's Confessions? Most of you. So Augustine describes this enchaining of his will. Do you remember there's a passage? It's a passage that I find especially, you know, beautiful and important also theologically. He talks about, I think it's like in book 5, where he's already decided that Christianity is true and that he should become a Christian. But he still can't bring himself to do it. And part of that is because of his, you might say, his addiction, his concupiscence to all of the unchastity that he's been living. So he knows he's going to have to give that up. And yet he wants to give it up, but he can't bring himself to give it up. And he talks about how puzzling it is. The only thing, he says, that I would need to do in order to become a Christian is to will to become a Christian. And I wanted to will that, and yet I could not will that. Okay, that's very peculiar. Because if the will is free, then if you want to change your choice, you should be able to. But he wasn't able to. What does that, and I think we've all had this sort of experience. What does that tell us? When we've committed a sin, we've actually decreased our freedom. And although on some level it remains possible for us to change the will, like it's just an act of the will, we discover that we can't actually do that. So our freedom has been diminished by sin. What Augustine needs is the grace of God, who will finally break his addiction to that sin and allow him to turn to what he really knows is right. And that's what Aquinas is talking about with the kind of grace of God moving the will to its free act. So this really does happen to us, and we experience it as a liberation. And now for the first time, we're able to be free in a higher way. It's not that we had no freedom before, but that freedom was in some way limited or deformed, and now it's being set free for its true use. So there is no conflict on Aquinas' account between God's motion of our wills and a free action. And the reason why that's the case, ultimately, for Aquinas, is because God is our creator, and he is the one who made us. And what did he make us with a will that is actually ultimately made for God? So that turning us towards God is not ever going to be against our nature. It's going to actually be the perfection of our nature, even the supernatural perfection of our nature. To put this another way, our wills are not a God-free zone where we do our own thing. God can enter into them and turn them to himself. Okay, I'm not going to go through the other texts here because time is passing, but I would like now to talk for a moment about, I want to talk about the possibility of resisting this offer of grace or this movement of grace, because that's already come up, and it's a question that a lot of people ask, and this may impinge on our ability to get to merit, but we'll just do our best. So a very key point here for talking about the possibility of resistance of grace, I mean, there are some, you might say, scriptural benchmarks. One of them is that God wills all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. So that foundational truth, absolutely, you know, from the perspective of the Catholic Church, this is a capital dogmatic truth. God wills all to be saved. But we do not know dogmatically that all are in fact saved. And in fact, it seems that some may not be saved. So that would then lead us to this position. God wills all to be saved, but if not all are in fact saved, those who aren't saved really could have been saved, but they weren't. Okay, so there's a lot of patristic reflection on this. I mean, Augustine is aware of this question. Prosper of Aquitaine talks about it. So the Catholic Church is going to need to say that somehow there is the real possibility that all would be saved because God wills the salvation of all. And yet there's also the possibility that it doesn't work out for all. Now, you could go in a different direction with this, and some of the Protestant reformers do. So Luther and Calvin, also Cornelius Jansen, who gives his name to Jansenism, which is not really Protestantism, but is a heresy sort of within the Catholic world that's basically around the same time as the Protestant Reformation and subsequently. Luther, Calvin, and Jansen present a new spin on this issue in the early modern period, but they all have a rather different theory of what the will is. They don't see the will as the faculty of rational desire, but really as a faculty of choosing, and they primarily work in a domain where they think of the will as obeying or disobeying. Obeying or disobeying a divine command. So this change to move from the will desiring a good to the will obeying a command, this is a very monumental change. It characterizes the difference between classical and medieval thought versus modern thought. And a lot of the modern debates, including the debates between Catholics and Protestants, happen like because of this shift. So that philosophical shift about like what is the will and what is really good, what is a morally good act, that's like deeply embedded in this debate. But we don't have time to go into all the parameters of that. I just want to flag that for you. But Luther, Calvin, and Jansen teach that the human will, after the fall, is radically damaged. And so it's just going to always be disobedient. And what God has to do is just like make it obedient. So it's going to, God just changes it from rebellion to obedience. And this doesn't require a robust sense of a free act by the human being. So that the net result is that the will just is forced, as it were, by God. And Luther, Calvin, Jansen, they're comfortable with saying something like that because they basically think the will has been so badly damaged that it doesn't have that freedom anymore. So we just have to like take the strong medicine of saying, yeah, God just forces you and it's not really free. The Catholic view and Thomas Aquinas never want to go that far, but they also don't have to because they have this older and different sense of what the will is doing and what the will's freedom consists in. Okay, so that's going to be a very big difference, and we can talk more about that in the Q&A if you like. But what I wanted, the corollary for Luther, Calvin, and Jansen is that God doesn't give grace to all, or at least not an interior grace. So the argument runs like this. All who receive interior grace are moved efficaciously to salvation. That's because, like, the grace just forces you. There's no possibility of resistance. And if we say not everyone is saved, which they all also do think, therefore it follows God doesn't give that grace to everybody. He only gives it to some. The one he gives it to, those ones, they turn. The ones he doesn't give it to, he just leaves them in a state of damnation. And that's often the way the contemporary debate frames this issue. Now, the Catholic Church and Aquinas doesn't take that view. Calvin has the hardest line here. He holds for what he calls double predestination. God predestines some to salvation. He predestines others to eternal damnation. And that's just the truth. We just have to accept that hard doctrine. Jansen, for his part, doesn't hold to a predestination to evil, but he does think that Christ died only for those predestined for salvation. So for Jansen, God just doesn't will the salvation of all. He only wills the salvation of some. And Jesus didn't die for all. He only died for some. He's not the savior of all. He's only the savior of some. Okay, so in response to this, the Catholic Church makes some very clear pronouncements. And what I'm going to articulate for you is like a Thomistic account of holding together Aquinas' views plus the church's response to Luther, Calvin, and Jansen. So the church, in response to them, makes clear that Jesus died for all, God calls all to salvation, and if some are not saved, it's their fault, not God's fault. Okay, so that's on the highest level, that's the answer. But two categories of grace flow from this. Now, these categories get labels that I think are sometimes not that helpful, but we're probably inevitably going to have to use them. The first category would be graces that are simply efficacious. So this is like what we just read in question 113, article 3. God moves the human will efficaciously to its free act. So you freely accept the grace that is being offered to you, and God is, in a way, the author of that free act, as also you are. So there's two sources of that act. And Aquinas thinks that in the end, you can't say that the creature just is able to turn. God has to help the creature turn, but you can turn, the creature can turn to a free act. So it's not being forced. It's freely doing it, and you'll experience it as free. Okay, but then there's another category, and we could call this the second category, category two. These are graces that are sufficient, but not of themselves, simply efficacious. Okay, so now there's two subsets of the second category. One subset, you could call it category 2A, would be a sufficient grace that really sets you up for some good act, but doesn't itself give you the power of the good act. Okay, so here's an example. A baby is baptized and therefore receives habitual grace, sanctifying grace. That baby's soul is really infused with the theological and infused moral virtues. Okay, so faith, hope, and charity. The baby has the real power to make saving acts. Salvation is really possible for that child now. So let's fast forward to 12 years old. And let's call this baby, I don't know, let's call him John. Okay, so John baptized, has the virtues. Now fast forward 12 years. John knowingly and with full consent of his will commits a mortal sin. Okay, up to that moment, he was in a state of sanctifying grace. The habitual grace that he had was interior, spiritual, sufficient for salvation. But he fell from grace through his own fault, and thus he lost the grace that he had received. And if he dies just after that sin without any further act of repentance, he may not be saved. Okay, did he receive a grace sufficient for salvation? Absolutely, yes. He was really offered that salvation. He really lost it through his fault. Okay, so that's one very good example of how we can understand God can really offer someone salvation, gives a grace sufficient for it, and it's through the person's fault that that grace is lost. Now, you could say, time out. Couldn't God have given, like at the moment he's thinking about that first mortal sin, couldn't God have like given him an actual grace to prevent him from doing it? What do you think the answer to that is? Yes, yeah, he could have. And you say, Lord, why didn't you give him that grace? Do we have an answer for that? I mean, the answer would be, did he deserve the grace? Was he owed the grace? He's not owed the grace. God does sometimes give graces like that. Maybe he's giving lots of graces to us like that. He's not obliged to do that. Was the sin the fault of the sinner? Yeah, it was John's fault. He could have not committed that sin. God was not forcing him to commit the sin. But God permitted him to engage in a free act of sin. Okay, that's very mysterious. And it puts us right back in the problem of sin. Why would God ever create a world where he lets the creature sin? Good question. But we don't really have an adequate account of that. In fact, there's never a good answer to the question, why did that guy commit a sin? Because sin is always stupid and damaging to yourself. There is never a good reason to do it. There's never a sufficient reason. So then maybe we should say, oh, nobody ever sins. Well, but obviously they do. Obviously we do. So there's not a good reason for it, but we do it. Another category of sufficient grace, this would be category 2B. This is a different kind of sufficient grace. This is the grace of a good thought or idea, for example, that doesn't result in a good act. So the first category was a habitual grace that would give you the power to do good acts, like all the way to the end of your life in theory, but that you can betray that grace by a sinful act. Okay, the second category is about an actual grace. So it could be the grace of a good thought or idea that doesn't produce an exterior act, or the grace of an interior act that you never follow through on. So here's a good example. Well, let's take the P.G. Woodhouse character, Bertie Wooster. I don't know if any of you read P.G. Woodhouse. but, you know, I can counsel you too. So Bertie Wooster is like this worldly guy, Englishman living in New York. Let's just suppose that he's in a state of mortal sin. Okay, so he's in a mortal state of mortal sin. He's given the interior grace by God of the thought, God will forgive me if I ask him to. I could go to confession today and I will be free of my sins. Okay, that is like the first preparatory step of an operative grace of conversion. But Bertie then reflects on all the things he'll have to give up if he becomes a practicing Catholic, and he can't let those things go. So he decides, I'm going to think about this another day. It's a nice idea. I'll think about it later. Okay, so that interior grace was efficacious as far as it went, right? So he really did receive a grace that got him to think about it. But that grace did not bring with it necessarily the activation of his will to actually resolve to do it. So the grace was efficacious for what it brought, and it was sufficient for the further act. Like, he really could have decided with his will to do something further, but he didn't. Okay, suppose the next week Bertie receives a further grace, and this time his will is activated to make the decision. I'm going to walk down to St. Vincent Ferrer Church, which is our church in Manhattan, and I'm going to go to confession. But then he gets a call from a friend saying, hey, let's have lunch. And he thinks, you know, I better eat something before I go to confession, because that's going to be tough. Like, I can't do that on an empty stomach. And at the restaurant, then he sits down and he says, you know, the martinis are really good at this place, and I'm going to need a martini if I'm going to make a good confession. Like, I need a drink to get myself ready. Okay? Can you predict how this is going to end? Like, he has one martini and two and three. Does he make his confession that afternoon? No, he does not. Okay. So he received an interior grace that really did cause an interior resolve of his will, but he didn't follow through to the end of the action. And only if he had followed through on the end of the action does that grace bear its full fruit. What was the problem there? He is an intemperate man. He has a lot of bad habits. So his vicious habit of intemperance led him, in effect, to resist the good work that God was doing in him. Okay, so he received a grace that was really sufficient for him to be saved. But it didn't overcome the pre-existing resistance that he had in him. So the grace that he got is really good. It really aims at his salvation. God wills, at least antecedently, his salvation and gives him the grace. But he has an obstacle in him, this intemperance, that God is not bound to remove. And the creature's resistance, then, is the reason why that grace does not produce the ultimate fruit of salvation. Okay, so we could once again say, okay, time out. Couldn't God give a grace that would overcome his intemperance? And I think, once again, we're back at that same analysis. Yeah, God could give the grace, but he's not obliged to give it. It's not unjust to him to inherit the consequences of his intemperance. So while it's possible for God to give a grace that goes further, God doesn't. And in that case, is it God's fault? And I think the classic, you know, some people want to say, yeah, well, if God could have done it and he didn't do it, then it's really God's fault. I think Christian theology wants to say, no, we can't say that it's God's fault. How did the resistance get there in the first place? Through the fault of this man. So he's inheriting the consequences of his own sins, and it's not wrong unjust to him for him to experience that. Okay, how to understand the resistance. This is my last point, and then I think I'll have to end. I'm afraid we won't get to merit. Is the resistance a positive act of the will? Or is it something else? I want to suggest that the resistance is not a positive act of the will, like refusing something. In other words, like somebody offers you the menu and you say, okay, I've considered that, I'm deciding against it. That would be, on a Thomistic account, I think, metaphysically incoherent, because an act of the will requires some positive act. And if God is giving the act to the will to freely accept the offer of grace, then the creature is going to freely accept the offer of grace. That act is just going to work. Metaphysically, it seems to me that this resistance can only be a privation, something missing that ought to be there, or some kind of creaturely deficiency, something that's not rightly ordered in the person, that prevents the person from making the fully good act that God is offering in his grace. So that could be a pre-existing vice. It could just be the absence of right order in the will. It could be the way that your will is in love with these lower goods. And, you know, it's like God is tapping you on the shoulder saying, hey, you know, you could give up that good and turn to me. And you're like not hearing it because you're so focused on the lower good that your will is stuck on. But that's, in the end, just to re-describe the state of sin. So in the end, I think what this brings us back to is God does permit sin to exist. And that brings with it the terrifying possibility that a creature, by its own fault, could lose God, even eternally. And that's frightening to us. God could save a creature. He can save a creature only, of course, by giving it the will to turn back to God. And he does do that. He does do that a lot. But in his justice, sometimes he seems to let us inherit the consequences of our sins, and we don't really understand how all of this works out. Maybe that's kind of a dark point to end on, but we're out of time. So we're going to have time to pray and to talk more about this, and hopefully we'll the retreat as a whole will not end on that.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. And it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.